Santana, we try to do things next to the minutes or so. Thank you all know about the, yeah, I guess the radio program is the podcast to this area, then it's a great GN. Sure, no, okay. Anyway. Not the commercial room, but some creative claims when she's, we talk about our creator and a lot of them think that we come up with some pretty wild claims about our creator, things that he has to do. To prop up the theory of evolution, which I assure you this is true, is under severe attack. Certainly it's been challenged for creation in years, but within the ranks of the evolutionists, there is great unrest. So what's happening is the claims get even be, I guess, crazier and crazier amongst evolutionists to try to keep propping it up and say, oh, everything is fine. Well, it's not. But a few of the things that I consider to be pretty wild, pretty creative, we're going to look at just a few this morning. For example, how many of you realize that birds are dinosaurs? You know, we were all taught, I mean, not long ago, the dinosaurs are extinct, right? You know that? Dinosaurs are extinct. Birds are dinosaurs. And this is a really cool picture of them. Imagine the dino bird. The Chicago Feeding Museum of Natural History is a, really excellent museum with a lot of different specimens about natural history. But as most natural history museums will have nowadays, they'll have a dinosaur exhibit, right? And so a couple years ago, I was at the field museum and went to the dinosaur exhibit. I always like to check out. It's the newest information about the dinosaurs. And if you go to the dinosaur exhibit, you will see this sign. So I'm not making this up. They claim that birds are dinosaurs. There it is. I have some pictures in the dinosaur exhibit. And they have a lot of different displays to try and help you understand how it is that birds are actually dinosaurs. There's one called a promaeosaur. And that little exhibit there for the kids to, not just kids, to push a button to compare then the bones of the promaeosaur with the bones of a bird, so that you can see, well, they're just the same. They're very much similar. The big comparison is the hips, the pelvis, because you've all seen pictures of dinosaurs that stand up on their hind legs, right? So they've got their forelimbs that the presentation is can evolve, can mutate, and eventually then become wings as opposed to needing all four legs to walk around. So in this particular display, you push the button and these bones light up, and these are the bones of a dinosaur that was like the bones of a bird. Is they don't describe how many changes actually are involved in evolving from a dinosaur into a bird. They just talk about the pelvis, and maybe the wings are ordered. Well, there are many more than this, but I'm going to just propose a short list of evolutionary changes that would have had to have occurred from an avian dinosaur. So they distinguish dinosaurs now as avian, that is bird, dinosaurs, and non-avian dinosaurs, the ones that walk around. These are just a short list of changes that would have had to have occurred, okay? Scales would have had to have become feathers. Well, scales sort of looks feathery, if you can imagine it getting in. But that's just in your imagination. If you look at the molecular biology, if you look at the protein structures involved in going from the scale to a feather, and all the material that's involved in the follicles that make the scale and embryo and feather, they're colossal. It's a huge amount of genetic information required. But anyway, scales have to become feathers. Four limbs have to become wings. So you go from legs to wings with those great big long bones and the feathers and everything, as well as the ligaments and all those things that are required for changing from a forelimb, a leg, to a wing. The comparative brain size grew from tiny. You've heard jokes about how dumb dinosaurs must have been because you've got this massive creature and it's got this tiny little peanut of a brain. In fact, a brontosaur was so big that you, and its brain was so small, it had to have sort of a nervous complex, nerve complex back in its tail region so that things could move together. Tiny brain to a huge brain, comparatively, for birds. Another thing that would have to change was a bellows-style lung. The bellows is those things that open and close and suck air in and blow air out, and you can get a coal fire to blaze hot. Bellows-style lung, which is what we all have, we're breathing in and out like a bellows, to a flow-through lung system, which is what birds have. A dramatically different design between bellows and flow-through lungs. Well, I'm not going to talk about the scales to feathers or the forelimbs to wings. I'm just going to talk about the brain size and the lung type. The dinosaur that weighed 4.5 metric tons, it would fit into the room, I guess. We're talking about a massive creature. 4.5 metric tons had a brain that weighed about 80 grains. That is 0.002% of its body weight. Birds, on the other hand, say a fairly large bird, about a kilogram of hawks, and birds weighing 1,000 grams would have a brain of about 14 grains in its weight. So that's about 1.3% of its body weight. So compare 0.002 to 1.3. A bird's brain is about 650 times larger. So, you know, next time you hear about a bird brain, big brain. But think about this. So this is another one of these things that we had with dinosaurs, the birds. Oh, wait. Birds are dinosaurs. Their brains would have had to evolve to be 650 times larger, going from an avian dinosaur to an avian creature. And then let's think about the human brain. In comparison, the human brain, not common brain, the human brain is generally about 2% of our body weight, right? On average, the comparison between Homo sapiens, is what we are, with the Australopithecus afarensis, the ape-like creature Lucy, you all heard of Lucy, that creature, well, the big difference, besides standing up and so forth, was the brain. Well, the human brain is about, I've got to keep advancing these things, I'm sorry. The human brain is only about 3 times larger than that ape-like creature that was so different. Now, granted, they claim that there were a lot of similarities, but still, our brains have only gotten 3 times larger than Australopithecus. And they make a big deal about that. But not much is made about a bird's brain having to be 600 times larger than a dinosaur brain. So that's one of the things that doesn't get mentioned a whole lot, but one of the things that it's interesting in reading a particular article about this brain size problem from dinosaurs to birds was they said, well, yeah, the bird brain is much, much larger. But after all, some dinosaurs, like Archaeopteryx, you've seen the picture of the half dinosaur, half moon, supposedly, actually, it was a bird. It flew, It lay, I mean, everything about it was a bird, just sort of a primitive bird. The brain size of some dinosaurs, like Archaeopteryx, was more similar to that of birds. Comparing a bird to a bird, not a dinosaur to a bird. There you go. Dinosaurs aren't extinct, they're birds, and they just got big brains real fast. Another very dramatic difference that dinosaurs would have had to evolve to become birds is their respiratory system, as I mentioned. And the big difference between the respiratory system of the dinosaur, or you, or a reptile, or a mammal, or any creature besides birds, is this change from the entire way air flows through the respiratory system. Now, we're familiar with fish, right? Fish, they bring the water through their mouth, out their gills. They have a kind of a flow-through system. Well, so do birds. Although, of course, it's not getting the air through water. It's getting the air right from the air, just like you and I do. And it's hard to even fathom how you could imagine this process of going from the bellows lung to an airflow lung, because one of the important structures that you have, that a dinosaur had, to be able to make these bellows work is a diaphragm. Now, your rib cage is sort of curved, if you feel it like this, it's curved, and your diaphragm is attached to that. When you breathe, what you've got to do is you've got to expand those bellows lungs, make them bigger, so that they bring air in. And then when you relax, your air flow goes out because your lungs get smaller again, just like a bellows. So you contract your diaphragm. It's curved, you contract your diaphragm, it gets straight, it opens up that cavity, and you breathe in, and you relax, and it breathes out. Okay, so you've got to have a diaphragm. Without a diaphragm, you can't breathe. Well, guess what? Birds don't have a diaphragm. So imagine somehow or other this creature has got to be able to breathe, but it loses its diaphragm as part of this process of going from bellows to airflow, and it still survives. And somehow this process is taking place, going from one kind of lung system to another. The diaphragm disappears. Here's a picture of a bird. Point out, okay, so it's breathing the air in here, and it's going into these air sacs, then it passes through lungs, goes into another air sac, then passes out the trachea again. It's not going back and forth like this. These air sacs all had to evolve. Here's a little diagram again of, well, the air will go in. Whoops. Yeah, well, this is even a better picture. The airflow goes in, is stored in an air sac. Then when the bird exhales, it goes through the lungs. Well, the air that was in this sac goes out. Then it breathes in again, it moves the air from the lungs into these air sacs. When it exhales, out it goes, so on and so forth. It flows through. This is why a bird, one, can breathe while it's flying. You can imagine if you're having to go back and forth like this when it's trying to fly, and why a bird's metabolism is so efficient, much more efficient than ours, because it's not mixing the air that has been oxygen depleted with the air that it's trying to get oxygen from. It's super efficient, highly metabolically active. That all, again, would have had to have happened from the perspective of how a dinosaur breathed getting to a bird and the way it breathes. So, I would submit to you that when they talk about birds being dinosaurs, just in the back of your mind, be reminded of, well, I don't think it's just quite that simple of standing up and getting big long forelimbs to fly around, let alone brain size, scales to feathers, the other things involved. But they make the claim now that, well, birds are dinosaurs. And they always show you an ostrich, don't they? Because it sort of looks like a dinosaur, right? See, they're just sort of barely changing. Very clever in the way it is presented. Well, how about this one? Here's another amazing claim. A 46,000-year-old nematode. You know what a nematode is? It's not a toad, it's a little tiny worm. And when you first say a 46,000-year-old nematode, well, that's not a big deal, is it? I mean, they claim dinosaurs went extinct 65 million years ago. So a 46,000-year-old worm, what's the big deal there? Well, what's the big deal is that the worm was still alive. They're claiming that it was a 46,000-year-old worm that was alive. How could that be? Well, it was frozen in the frost of Siberia. Now, if you look at this chart here, this is where they found it. It's weird to look at the Earth from the North Pole. And so there's an Earth Pole. So Canada is here. Here's Russia. And the area of Russia that they were doing this research, looking into the permafrost, is right about in here. All right? And this is a little chart of some of the layering. What's curious about the permafrost as it thaws out is there'll be fingers down in where it's frozen here and it's thawed out there. So anyway, they've been doing a lot of research because some of this permafrost is melting, it's thawing. And they got some of this permafrost and they thawed it out and they found this and as they're looking at it under a microscope, it starts wiggling. It's alive. It's astounding. Another thing that they found in this kind of permafrost is they found just recently, very recently, a 35,000-year-old, according to the way they date, saber-toothed kitten. This thing looked just like as if the cat had just died. They froze it and then thawed it out to go bury it. It looked perfectly fine, except that it was just frozen and dead. So these days, a 46,000-year-old living worm, the cat didn't come back. It's a little complex to imagine. But the things that they're finding in the permafrost are really, really fascinating. So here's an electron micrograph of the worm. To get a feel for how big it is, it's not even like a kind of worm. Here's a chart. That length of worm is 0.88 millimeters. You know, millimeter is, it's the thickness of a dime. Okay, so this worm is a little shorter than the width of a dime. So, you know, if you've got decent eyes, a lot of people probably wouldn't be able to see it, but if you got decent eyes, you'd see it. It's a little black speck, but to see its structures and so forth, you're going to need a microscope. In these cases, like I said, they were using an electron microscope. But here are the structures of this amazing worm, and they claim that it was frozen 46,000 years ago, and it stayed alive. It was dormant, stayed alive through a process they call cryptobiosis. And when they thawed it out, there it was, all the structures, the nervous tissue, the muscles, all the things that go on, the respiratory structures, and that it was all still functional. It was alive. This was just published just last year. It's a year and a half ago. I'll read a little bit from the area published in the Library, Public Library of Science, the Genetics Edition. This is the title. Interpret the title. A novel, that means new. Okay? A new nematode species from the Siberian permafrost shares adaptive mechanisms. That is, it has developed various abilities through its biochemistry and physiology and so on and so forth. Well, cryptobiotic surviving. Put it in a deep freeze and it survives once you thaw it. Mechanisms for cryptobiotic survival with C. elegans dowry. Where is C. elegans in our? Well, I'd be surprised to know that these nematodes are a common source of research. Fair bit, because those systems are so complex. It has a nervous system, it has a digestive system, it has a respiratory system, it's got muscles, it's got all these things. Obviously, it's incredibly simple and small, but there are so many things that we can learn from these tiny worms. And so they were comparing this new species, as they called it, of nematode with one that we know a lot about. And they have similar adaptive mechanisms. Here's a quote from the paragraph that introduces the article. Some organisms in nature have developed the ability to enter a state of suspended metabolism called cryptobiosis. We here present precise radiocarbon dating indicating that Panagrolinus, that was the name of this new nematode, individuals have remained in cryptobiosis since the late Pleistocene, that is, for 46,000 years. Now, that's quite a claim. A few hundred years, something frozen, we've got examples of this. We know when it was frozen. But you might ask, well, how did they come up with 46,000-year-old worm? Well, there's not enough material there to date carbon date worm, but there is biomass, vegetation and so forth in the frozen material, in the permafrost, that they get plenty of in carbon dating the material. So what they're claiming is they've taken the biomass, they've taken this vegetative matter and radiocarbon dated, that's 46,000 years old. So this is what I just want to emphasize again that they're the ones that are saying this. They've got the issue. Well, this is 46,000 years old, so it's amazing. It's formed and lived. But then they come up with explanations about this. How amazing it has been able to adapt to being frozen for 46,000 years and then still wake up and go on about its business. The author, the well-known researcher in molecular cell biology, said this: the radiocarbon dating is absolutely precise. And we now know that they really survived 46,000 years. Now, he says that because a different kind of C. elegans was found several years ago, and they were thinking, man, this is in 40,000-year-old material. And it was sort of hard to believe, and there was a lot of controversy about it. But then they found this one, and with the dating and everything, notice how absolutely certain they are that this is an absolutely precise date. Well, you know, that's all okay. If the assumptions that are used to radiocarbon date something are accurate, in other words, we haven't been able to go back and get a videotape of this worm being frozen 46,000 years ago, or for that matter, anything else that we're radiocarbon date, unless it's some artifact that, you know, we know a human is making. So how did they come up with 46,000 years? Well, there are assumptions. The key one, there are several, I'm not going to go into all of them. The key one is you have to know how much radiocarbon was in the specimen when it died, so that then you can compare what it started with when it was alive to how much is in there now, and you then extrapolate how long it takes radiocarbon to decay, and you go, okay, it started with this much now, it's all the way down to this much, it took this long for that to happen. The thing is, if the specimen started out with less radiocarbon in it, and how could that be? Well, if the atmosphere had less carbon-14 in it, then it was alive, like maybe before the flood, or right after the flood. Instead of it actually being old because there's less radiocarbon-14 in it, it is perceived to be old when in fact it just started with a lot less radiocarbon in it, and it isn't near 46,000 years old. Does that make sense? When these assumptions are applied to these measurements, if your assumption is wrong, frankly, the dating pretty much means it. So his statement, we're absolutely precise. Yeah. If your assumptions are right, sir, but if your assumptions are wrong, in these dates, frankly, we just came from. I think it's pretty absurd to think that a little worm could survive 46,000 years physiologically intact and then wake up and start falling into the image. I'll go through this very quickly because we're time to be some. How about some primitive paleontologists? Paleontologists are people that study fossils. Sand people, it used to be called Bushmen, it's not politically correct now to call them Bushmen. The sand people of South Africa, this is how they still live. They're very, very primitive people, hunter-gatherers. are said now to have been excellent paleontologists. There is some amazing rock paintings in South Africa, 200-year-old rock paintings that depict a strange animal, an animal that isn't alive today, that supposedly went extinct 250 million years ago. And in this article, not even a year ago, they were commenting about how did these people find this creature? How would they know anything about this extinct animal and paint it on the wall? Let me read this really quickly. Between 1821 and 1835, the Sand People painted in a bath scene on a cliff this famous painting called the Horned Serpent Pan. And it depicted warrior spears and recognizable animals and a mysterious addition, the touched creature with a long curved body, polka dots on its skin, and it didn't resemble anything that's alive today. But what they noted was this creature looked like a Dicynodont. A Dicynodont, by the way, is the mammal from which all mammals have evolved some 200 and some million years ago. Again, this is published in one of these journal articles that the Smithsonian was commenting on. So here's a deer as part of the painting. Here's another one. And you can't see it, but I'll show you another picture. The creature that they're talking about is right in here. See that curvature right there? We'll move forward and look at a close-up of it. Here's, see the dots here? And right there, those are the tusks on this animal. And here's a rendition of what they think the painting originally looked like. Now, what do you see going on here? You've got these people hunting. They've got spears, they've got arrows, and here's, maybe that's a giraffe, an ox, a porcupine, here's those deer, and here's this thing. And they go, what in the world is that? It doesn't fit anything that's alive today, but it does fit what we know was a creature that lived a long time ago, called the Cynodont. And here's the explanation of how they could have this amazing animal that couldn't have been around when they hunted. This work supports the idea that the first inhabitants of South Africa, the sand hunter-gatherers, discovered fossils, interpreted them, and integrated them in their rock art and belief system. Now, here's what the fossils look like. You've seen shows about digging fossils, right? I mean, it's painstaking. You get in there with a brush and a scalpel, and you uncover it, and then you got to get the bones, and you put them together to form a skeleton and all this. And supposedly, these people were digging fossils and going through all the process of putting these fossils together to get a picture of a Dicynodont and putting it into their rock system. Here's an artist's rendition of a Dicynodont. You know, there is a lot better, lot simpler explanation of how it is that they can include a Dicynodont in their depiction of hunting excursions. What would that be? Well, there was the Dicynodont around, alive, when they were hunting 200 or so years ago. They're extinct now. At least we haven't found any lately. But the claim is that there's some other explanation. You got to keep this theory propped up. Is, wow, these people were expert paleontologists. Again, what's a better explanation? Well, I would say a better explanation we can find very simply. In Genesis chapter 1, it says, and God made the beasts of the earth after their kind, that would include Dicynodonts, and cattle after their kind, and everything that creeps on the ground after its kind. And then you move to the next verse, and it says, and God said, let us make man in our image. These creatures and man were all on the earth at the same time. And I think a much more reasonable and much more common sense explanation than these people that were living hand to mouth hunter-gatherers were expert paleontologists. And creative claims by the evolutionists to keep it propped up, because challenge after challenge is being mounted for a theory that is far from reasonable and certainly in absolute opposition to the word of God. Lord, thank you for these things that we continue to discover. Not that your word needs to be proven. Lord, it is encouraging, and it encourages our faith. And it's just the kind of thing that I pray that you would not only encourage us, but maybe we could remember some of these things and share them with those that are so deceived. Pray these things in Jesus' name.